Remember that basically Daniel 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12 are focusing on a particular period in Israel's history. So Daniel is standing back here in the 6th century BC, somewhere around 586, and he is prophesying, and he is looking forward about 400 years to 168, where there will be the most intense persecution that the Jews have ever experienced, because a ruler called Antiochus Epiphanes basically tried to destroy, obliterate biblical religion. And so that is the historical, the first historical fulfillment of the book of Daniel. And this was spread over a seven-year period approximately, ending with the cleansing, well, the defilement of the temple in 168, and then its cleansing in about 165 with the victory of the Maccabees. However, what Daniel does is he then uses this, so he's standing back here, back in the 6th century, he's looking forward 400 years, but then he uses this as an aperture, a keyhole, through which we can view the events in 33 AD with our Lord going to the cross. And so using this fulfillment as a mirror, as an aperture, as a keyhole to see what's happening in 30 AD, then using this to see what's going to happen at the end of the age. And so that's how the book of Daniel is presented to us. And so you get multiple levels of fulfillment, but you're using a very clear historical grid, something that happened in 168 that we know a lot about now through the book of Maccabees. We use that now as a paradigm for understanding. Jesus spoke of the abomination of desolation, the destruction of the temple that would happen in 70 AD. And then John in the book of Revelation picks up Daniel themes. And we'll see that worked out again this morning. But let me remind you of the intensity of this persecution under Antiochus. He eliminated the high priesthood. He rededicated the temple to a Greek god. He put an idol on the altar of burnt offering. He set it up there and sacrificed a pig. He commanded the Jews to break Torah completely, eliminate the Torah, the Pentateuch, to eat pork. You could not circumcise your child. If you did, the child was executed and you were executed. He banned the Sabbath. He put some prostitutes in the temple. Then he went from village to village carrying around an idol, forcing each village to bow the knee to the idol and to eat pork. Now that's not persecution. That is seeking to obliterate biblical religion. And that's why this paradigm, something that happened in history, okay, it was prophetic when Daniel wrote it, but now we can read about it, okay? That becomes keyhole number one, through which we see the events of the cross and the destruction of Jerusalem. Number two, through which we see the events at the end of the age. Number three, that's how Daniel worked. And so we're going to come now to, and again I've showed you, these are the bookends of the historical fulfillments, okay, working our way through the various beasts, which we've identified as Babylon, Media, Persia, Greece. Okay, the historical fulfillment takes place here with the defilement of the temple in 168. You remember it's a seven-year period because at the beginning Antiochus appears to be a friend to the Jews, but after about 3.5 years he becomes their mortal enemy, and eventually through the rise of the Maccabeans, he is overthrown. So this is a huge crisis in the history of Israel, and was celebrated and is still celebrated today in which feast? Hanukkah, that's right. And I mentioned last week that the temple was actually defiled by Antiochus on December the 25th. I don't know that we can make too much of that because calendars change, but it is interesting to note, because of course Jesus would be the temple, as we will see in the book of Daniel. So if you take your sheet that says Daniel's 70 weeks, and we want to read where we got to last week, which was the end of chapter 9. And I want you to follow this closely, and don't worry too much if your translation's a little different. Now, this is an astonishing piece of prophecy, because we can get from this prophecy the date of the crucifixion. And I'll show you. Now, remember Daniel standing back in about 586 BC and he's giving this astonishing prophecy. This is why many critics say the book of Daniel was not written. Okay, the book of Daniel was not written back here in the 6th century. The book of Daniel was probably a book written in about the 1st century BC, after these things had happened, because you can't have prediction as specific as this. So we often speak about not Daniel in the lion's den, but Daniel in the critic's den, because the book of Daniel is the most fiercely attacked of all the biblical prophets by those who would embrace form criticism or higher criticism. 9:24. 70 weeks of years are decreed concerning your people and your holy city. And you remember, we work in decades. They worked in units of seven. So it's be like us saying 70 decades, 70 weeks. Okay, what will happen then? To finish transgression, to put an end to sin, and to atone for iniquity. This will happen at the end of this period. And to bring in everlasting righteousness. To seal up both vision and prophet, which really means to fulfill. The word seal can be used in the sense of fulfilling it. And to anoint a most holy place, the Holy of Holies. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the word to restore and rebuild Jerusalem, okay, which was in 444, okay, when Nehemiah was sent back. It wasn't when Cyrus sent them back. He gave them permission, you remember, to build the temple. Okay, but this is from the decree going forth to rebuild Jerusalem, to the coming of an anointed one, a prince. There shall be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. Now you may want to put a little parenthesis round the phrase that comes, it shall be built again with streets and squares, etc., however it reads, but in a troubled time. You can just parenthesis that, because that is referring to the historical period. Okay, in 168, I'll explain it. Verse 26, and after the 62 weeks, an anointed one shall be cut off. This is the Isaiah 53 word, and shall have nothing. And the people of the prince who is to come, people of the prince who is to come, shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. Its end shall come with a flood, and to the end there shall be war, desolations are decreed. And he shall make a strong covenant with many for 1 week, 7 years. And for half the week he shall cause sacrifice and offering to cease. That was the second half of the period with Antiochus. And upon the wings of abomination shall come one who makes desolate until the decreed end is poured out on the desolator. Now, take your sheet and we'll unpack this. We can read this through the lens of 168. We can read this through the lens of 33 AD. And we can read this through the lens of Revelation. And I'll take you through. Number one, we can read them as the historical events under Antiochus. And I'll show you how you can read them that way. Okay? However, not everything quite fits. Number two, we can read them as the 483 years from Nehemiah to the cross, and I'll explain that. But then there's still 1 week missing, because that's only 69 weeks, and there's 70. We can read them as the eschatological events at the end of the age under the reign of the Antichrist. But even this picture is only completed by the other two. So we need all three of them. It's like trinoculars, if there is such a thing, if you had three eyes. Okay, the reason why the three are overlaid rather than separated out is because one illuminates the other. And all three participate in the same underlying spiritual reality, the work of the enemy to devastate the people of God. And of course the victory of the Lord. Now we can read this as having happened, okay, in 168, 165. Let me explain. So the first fulfillments, which of course is now history, this scheme is partially fulfilled in the rededication of the temple. That should be 165. It was desecrated in 168. And it can be translated. The Hebrew can be translated this way. Hebrew is flexible enough to do this. Okay, so what would happen with the rise of the Maccabees is that rebellion would be ended. God would do away with these failures. He would wipe away waywardness. He would bring in lasting vindication to his people. He would fulfill, at least initially, Daniel's prophecy, and the most holy place would be reconsecrated or reanointed. It could be read in the Hebrew that way. And so how they work it out, and this is how many Jews would work this out. How do you work out the 70 years? They would work it out like this. We go from 605 to 556, which is when Cyrus becomes the leader of the Empire of Media. It's in 538 that he becomes the Emperor of Persia. So that gives us 49 years. We go from 605 to the death of the high priest, Onias, under Antiochus, and that gives us another 434 years. And then we go from 171 to 164, the rededication of the temple, or 165, another 7 years, bringing us up to the 490 years. However, what do you see as the problem with that? Can you see any... it can be calculated that way, but do you see anything slightly odd about that? Why would you add together two overlapping periods? Do you get the point? If we're giving a length of time, this begins in 605, ends in 556, this begins in 605, ends in 171. Why add two overlapping periods of time? You can read it, and certainly Jews at the time would read it through this lens, this first lens. But it doesn't quite fit. You get the point. And it's not supposed to quite fit. It's supposed to help them at that period of time, but it doesn't quite fit. And so I've said, you know, this fits what happened historically, but not quite. In a similar way to Isaiah 7:14, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son. And that was to be a sign to Hezekiah. Okay? And before that child was 12 years old, approximately, the kingdoms Hezekiah was fearing would be removed, at least as a threat. So something had to happen in the days of Hezekiah. A child had to be born, but wasn't born to a virgin and wasn't called Emmanuel. Okay, you do read of a child being born, okay, actually to Isaiah. And so it fits, but not quite. And so let's go to the next level, which fits beautifully. And so we come to the Christological interpretation a little bit further down. The elements of verse 24 are perfectly fulfilled in the work of Jesus on the cross. Okay, to finish transgression, put an end to sin, which is why he says his last words are on the cross. it is finished, and to atone for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, because the problem with the sacrifices is that they had to be repeated again and again, but he brings in everlasting righteousness. He fills full all the law and the prophets, okay, to seal up both vision and prophecy, to fill it full, to anoint a most holy place. He says, destroy this temple, this body, and in 3 days I will do what? I'll raise it up, okay? So he rises, we rise with him as his body, and the holy place is anointed at Pentecost, exactly. It's anointed at Pentecost, and then even in Ephesians, where Paul is speaking about the end of Ephesians 2, that the whole structure, remember, grows into a holy temple in the Lord. The word holy temple there is the word for the Holy of Holies, the Naus, N-O-U-S, the Naus. And so then, at the day of Pentecost, the most holy place was anointed. And so we go back to our little scheme, and now we find the 70 weeks really seem to work. Now, this was a scheme introduced by one of the church fathers, Julius Africanus. He lived in the second century, and this is what he worked out. Okay, we have in the text 7 weeks and 62 weeks before, it says in verse 24, before an anointed one will be cut off, the Isaiah 53 word for the cross. Okay, that adds up to 483 years. Now, just skip down a little bit. The decree to rebuild Jerusalem was issued in 444 BC, Nehemiah chapter 1. Okay, 444 BC plus the 69 years, okay, or the 69 decades, the 69 weeks, okay, brings us up to 39 AD. However, we have to do some calendar adjustments. We adjust the calendar for a year of 360 days, and 39 AD becomes 33 AD, the dates of the crucifixion. And in fact, we don't have time to get into it, but we can actually work it out to the date of the Passover, if we had the time. Now, this is an astonishing, astonishing prophecy. But back here, in the 6th century BC, Daniel is going to give us the dates of the crucifixion, when atonement will be made, when everlasting righteousness will be brought in, when an anointed one will be cut off, etc., etc. It is an astonishing, astonishing piece of prophecy. However, what's the problem with this? We're missing a week. We're missing a week. Now, that's fine, because it says, you know, that after the 7 weeks and the 62 weeks, an anointed one will be cut off. But we've still got a bit more to come. And so it's all fulfilled, but not quite. There's a week left hanging. And of course, you remember, these events under Antiochus lasted for a week, 7 years. And so this is what's going to be picked up in the book of Revelation, and we'll look at it in a minute, when this last seven-year period, broken into, again, the first half of 3.5, second half, 3.5, just like under Antiochus, will be worked out in the book of Revelation. And so it's fulfilled, but there's still some more to come, which is how we're supposed to read Daniel. So go to the last bit, which says an eschatological interpretation. And I say, the kingdom has come through the death and resurrection of Jesus, but 1 week of Daniel 70 remains to be fulfilled. The kingdom is now, but not yet. This last week is divided into the two periods, and they're picked up in the book of Revelation. And I've given you four references in the book of Revelation. And then all of what we've read, to end rebellion, put away sin, wipe away iniquity, bring in everlasting righteousness, fulfill prophecy, and anoint the most holy place, of course, is completely fulfilled in Revelation 20 21 and 22. And I've given you the references. And the activities of Antiochus, described in Daniel 8, then become the paradigm through which we can understand the strategy of the Antichrist at the end of the age. The adjustments of the to a 360-day year. There were many calendars being used in the ancient world. Probably in Daniel's day, at least four calendars were in use. And we'll see this in chapter 12. And so what we have to do, okay, to get what we're using, a Julian calendar of 365 days, okay, and so we have to make an adjustment, do you see what I mean, from the calendar Daniel was using, which was of 360 days, to our calendar of 365. Do you see what I mean? Which then we have to adjust for the calendars to come up with 33 AD on the Julian calendar. Okay. It's just technicalities of calendars. We're very used to a normative calendar, but that's a fairly recent thing. You know, the calendars have been kind of codified, you know. Often you travel around and they'd be using an entirely different one. And we want to, one thing I should say, and this is important in the light of Laura's question, is of course many people used to say, well, you know, this is all very fine, but this was probably written after it happened. You know, you got this astonishing prophecy. Yeah, it's probably written, you know, after it happened. But since the Dead Sea Scrolls and other issues, we know that we have in our hand, okay, Daniel written B.C. We've got manuscripts since the Dead Sea Scrolls and others as well. I might have mentioned to you before, this is a picture. Did I show you this before?
Yes.
Okay, some of you saw this before. This is a storeroom off a library in Cambridge, and here's this scholar sitting in 1898, over 100 years ago, and it looks like boxes and boxes of trash. And what it is, it was the most astonishing find in a Geniza in Cairo. A Geniza was the room in the synagogue where you would bring any document or any book that had the name of God on it. You couldn't throw it away if it had the name of God on it. It would have to be buried on sacred, consecrated ground, if it was scripture or even if it was a piece of paper with the name of God on it. And so every synagogue had this storeroom where you came with your stuff. You wouldn't throw your Bible away or, you know, whatever. You bring it to the Geniza. And then once in a while, the rabbis would clear out the Geniza and bury, you know, the books on sacred, consecrated ground. Well, for some reason, this Geniza in Cairo was not cleared out for 1,000 years. And it was the most phenomenal discovery, you know, not been cleared out for over 1,000 years. And of course, when they went in there, you know, clouds of dust, and as they began to pick up, it hardly ever rains in Cairo. Hardly ever. It's irrigated from the Nile. And so, you know, papyrus, you know, can last indefinitely. But it fragmented as they picked them up. And that's why it looks like a bunch of trash. 140,000 fragments in this room. Rather he'd sorted them out than me, you know. So we owe a great debt to these kind of, you know, these bookworms, you know, these guys who we don't know their names. But what we do know from it, what we do know from it is Daniel, we have in our hands authentic Daniel, okay? We can't prove that it was written in the 6th century, but we certainly can prove it was written B.C. It was written B.C. We know that. We've got extant manuscript evidence it was written B.C. And so we have this astonishing prophecy that was written before time, giving us the dates of the crucifixion. It is one of the most astonishing of biblical prophecies. Let's go to Revelation 12 for a minute, and let's pick up that 1 week that's still hanging around there, kind of floating around, waiting for us to pick it up. And I'm not going to spend long in Revelation, as that's another study. But let me just point out how some of this is picked up without explaining it all in the book of Revelation. Chapter 12. And you'll notice how all the Daniel symbolism comes back into play. And in fact, why don't we start with 13:1, the dragon we're going to see in chapter 12, who is Satan. And now we have, in chapter 13 and verse 1, we have the beast, the Antichrist. Now what have we been seeing in Daniel? A whole bunch of beasts. That's right. And I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, exactly the way the beasts in Daniel 7 came up out of the sea. And he had 10 horns and 7 heads, the same kind of apocalyptic description, each with 10 crowns on its horns and each head a blasphemous name. And the beast I saw, now look at this, resembled a leopard, that was Daniel 7, but had feet like a bear, that was Daniel 7, and mouth like a lion, that was Daniel 7. And so he represents all that was bestial in the empires of the world is kind of wrapped up now in this Antichrist figure. And the dragon gave its power and his throne and his authority to the beast. Because as we've said before, the principalities and powers, they want to incarnate themselves, okay, in people. If they can incarnate themselves in Stalin, they can do massive amounts of damage. And so it would seem that the Antichrist, okay, will be a person. Some people think the Antichrist is just a principle or a godless system. But Paul does speak of the man of perdition, which we'll see in a minute. It's all Daniel symbolism. So go back to 12, and we'll see again. I just want to pick up one instance of the 3.5 years. Okay, this last week that is left to be fulfilled. Daniel 12 and verse 1. A great and wondrous sign appeared where? In heaven. So we're looking at a spiritual reality in heaven, okay? And I think we're looking at the church in its heavenly manifestation. Just like in the book of Acts, we see it in its physical manifestation, in Ephesus, in Corinth, in Antioch. Now we're looking at the church as it appears in heaven, in its spiritual reality, as raised up with Christ. A woman clothed with the sun, okay, with the moon under her feet and a crown of 12 stars on her head. Probably a metaphor for the church. And she was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. And the great mass of the church is always giving birth, thank God. Okay, and so we get to the, let's go to the medieval period, just as an example. We get the great mass of the church, but it births something, a new movement, okay, that brings back biblical truth. Okay, we call it the Reformation. Go to the 18th century, get the great mass of the church, but it births the Great Awakening and all that flowed from that. And so the church, we can't dishonor the church, because it may not be what it, you know, it's like the rose bush. You know, you cut it right back. It's amazing, you know, cut it right back, you know, now. But what springs out of this dead wood? Looks like dead wood. What springs out? New life. That's what's always happening. And so this woman is giving birth. Then another, I think it's always out of suffering that the church gives birth. Verse 7, because travail is pain. Every mother knows that, travail is pain. Verse 3, then another sign appeared, where? In heaven. So this is all going on in the heavenly realm. An enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns. Okay, so we're back to Daniel's symbolism. And 7 crowns on his head. And he's waiting there to devour what is being born. And the enemy always does that. And so if God tries to birth something, the enemy is there waiting to consume what is being birthed. And all the way through the book of Revelation, beginning in chapters 2 and 3, God is trying to birth What group of people? They're called the overcomers. That's right. And so he who overcomes, which means not the whole body of the church will overcome, but there are promises to those that do. And the church is always birthing overcomers. And that is that section of the church that is on the cutting edge of what God is seeking to do. And so verse 5, she gave birth to a son, a male child, which is always the metaphor of those who get the inheritance, who will rule the nations with a rod of iron. And this is the promise given to the overcomers in Revelation 2:27. Rule the nations, that's the overcomers. It's also the promise given to the saints in Daniel chapter 7, if you remember. And her child was snatched up to God and his throne. Now, I don't believe this is a secret rapture for the simple reason that where's this all taking place, this vision? It's already in heaven. So what's born is often caught up to a new level of spiritual authority. So we're in the heavenlies, but we know there's more than one level in the heavenlies. So what's born is now caught up, okay, to throne room authority, which is often true of what God births. It has new authority on the earth. And so it's caught up. Now we'll see it again in a moment. And the woman, okay, she's not abandoned. She flees into the desert, an Exodus motif. She's not yet ready for her inheritance, not yet ready for the promised land, not yet ready for warfare, but she's not abandoned to a place prepared for her by God where she might be taken care of for how long? 1,260 days, which is 3.5 years. 3.5 years. Here we go back to Daniel. Verse 7, and there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels and the overcomers, okay, doesn't say it specifically, but why are they caught up to the throne? To drink coffee? No, to join in the warfare. And so Michael now is engaging, okay, the dragon in the heavenlies, and what the church has birthed is joining him. Okay, Michael now reappears from the book of Daniel. We haven't seen him since the book of Daniel, but suddenly he's on stage again, warring with the angels and by implication with the saints, because they've been caught up to the throne. And so this 3.5 year period, this is only one instance. Only one instance of it being mentioned. There are four, at least in Revelation. Okay, so we're working our way through. 6th century B.C., 168, a seven-year period. Okay, Antiochus is somewhat of a friend for 3.5 years, and then last 3.5 years a mortal enemy. We look through that aperture, we see the cross, we see the events of 70 A.D., another abomination of desolation when the Romans desecrate the temple. We look through that aperture, that keyhole, and we see the end of the age, which we have to because there's not quite 70 weeks fulfilled. Up to here was 69 fulfilled. So there's one hanging loose that's picked up in the book of Revelation. Here we have what I did last week, and we've got the Antichrist described in 1 John twice, 2 Thessalonians twice, and Revelation, he appears, okay. Notice Paul's language, okay, is he's the man of sin, the son of perdition, and the lawless one. Paul's not using apocalyptic language. But when we get to the book of Revelation, okay, he's not described in these terms, a man, a son of perdition, a lawless one. How's he described in Revelation? As a beast, that's right. It's a different kind of genre of literature. But it's very, very important, very, very graphic, very, very meaningful. Okay, that's Daniel chapter 9. Let's go on to Daniel chapter 10. Now, this is a lead-up to the vision in 11. Okay, this is the kind of preamble to this vision that he sees about the future in chapter 11. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on chapter 10, but there are some important things that we should say. Okay? Verse 2. In those days, I, Daniel, was mourning. That's always a word for fasting in Hebrew, for 3 weeks. Mourning and fasting are sometimes interchangeable. I ate no delicacies, no meat or wine entered my mouth, and I didn't anoint myself at all for the full 3 weeks. And what we learn again is that there wasn't much fasting in Israel. There was only one mandatory fast day in Israel, which was Day of Atonement. Yom Kippur. Yeah. Only one mandatory fast day. A lot of feasting in Israel, a lot of celebration, because we're supposed to be a joyful. Only one mandatory fast day, but there was lots of fasting, and Daniel here fasts, and we learn that fasting adds something to our prayers. Secondly, angels sometimes appear as men. Okay, Hebrews 13:1. Sometimes we entertain them unaware. So you can't say you've never met an angel. You probably have. You just didn't recognize him. I would suspect that all of us have met angels from time to time, but we just didn't know that they were angels. And we have that in Hebrews. We have that with Abraham. Genesis 18:3, men arrive, and he thinks it's three visitors. But sometimes they appear in their unveiled glory. And so look with me in verse 5. I lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, a man clothed in linen. Still appears as a man, but whose loins were like gold of Uphaz. His body was like beryl. Beryl is green. It's probably better translated yellow quartz or the Greek chrysolite, kind of almost gold, beautiful, shining kind of yellow. His face like the appearance of lightning, his eyes like flaming torches, his arms and legs like the gleam of burnished bronze, and the sound of his words like the noise of a multitude, or sound of many waters in other. Is this the Lord? We don't know. But the interesting thing is that Daniel is now probably around 82 years old, and his visionary capacity seems to just get larger and larger and larger. That's a great challenge, you know, because, you know, some people, you know, their vision of the Lord seems to shrink as they get older. You know what I mean? Some of us have met people, and it sometimes seems that the rising up-and-comers are those who are having, you know, visions and whatever. But Daniel is now certainly at least 80, and just his vision is expanding. And of course, he is overwhelmed, both physically and psychologically, by this vision. And you needn't turn to all those verses, but just let me read you some of the phrases. I'll pick them out. He trembled greatly. His strength left him. His radiant appearance was fearfully changed. He had no strength. He fell on his face in a trance. He was struck dumb, and he says, "Oh, my Lord, by reason of the vision, turmoil has convulsed me." And so this vision was so overwhelming that it was almost physically he couldn't contain it. Why? Why? That's right. He's been looking at the beasts. He's been looking at the beasts, you know, representing the magnificent power of Babylon, you know, the magnificent power of Persia, magnificent power of Greece. These were mighty, mighty empires. And God says, "Hang on a minute, Daniel. I'm just going to show you some real." We never read of this reaction when he saw the beasts, okay? But when he sees the Lord's power, he simply comes unglued, you see. And that's what we need to see. That's what we need to see. And so, hey, he can see the beasts, and hey, they're terrible. They're frightening. They're powerful. But when he sees the Lord, or whether this is an angel, he just comes unglued. And that's what we need to see. We need to see the Lord, or at least his angelic representatives. And that's when we're going to have faith, is to increase his faith. He's three times called a man greatly beloved, which is interesting because in the book of John, you remember, there's the disciple whom Jesus loved. Comes three times in the book of John, three times in the book of Daniel. Now, John has an appendix on it. You remember 21 is an appendix where he also appears. But the body of John ends in chapter 20. 13, 19, and 20 of the book of John, there is the disciple whom Jesus loved. Okay, and Daniel is called a man greatly beloved. Now, why this is important for the prophetic is we share our secrets with those we love. That's right. And you remember we get this graphic picture of in the upper room, John is leaning on the bosom of Jesus. That's right, because they would be circular, reclining on couches. Mm-hmm. And so John leaning down, they'd be kind of spread out like this. His head would be near the heart of Jesus. And that's a metaphor. You see, we'll hear prophetically, okay, God shares his secrets with those he loves. And John has his head near the heart of Jesus, and he can pick up the whisper of who the traitor is. And Daniel can pick up the whispers of what the Lord is speaking. That's why we get this description. Verse 12, if you'd like to go there, we'll read that together. A well-known verse, verse 12. The angel said, "Fear not, Daniel, for from the first day that you set your mind to understand and humble yourself before your God, your words have been heard, and I have come because of your words." From the very first day. Now we need to really get hold of this, that sometimes when we seek God, from the very first day, boom, we get right through to heaven. Right through. Boom. We're right there. But sometimes we take unanswered prayer as an indication, okay, that this might not be the will of God. But what we clearly see here is immediately God responds. But he's got to break through the demonic principalities and powers to get this back to Daniel. And so sometimes unanswered prayer is an indication of the will of God. And that's why it's interesting that Jesus virtually only says two things about prayer. If you track it through the gospel, virtually when Jesus teaches on prayer, he gives us the Lord's Prayer, which is an outline of worship and petition and forgiveness. But when he's teaching on prayer, he only says two things. One is faith, and the other is what? Persistence. That's right. I've given the references in Luke 11. He gives the Lord's Prayer, and then he tacks on it the parable, you remember, of the man who has a visitor in the night, and he goes banging on the door of a friend to wake him up, and he won't stop banging until the man gets up. And then Luke 18, the persistent widow. And so it's interesting that Jesus says, okay, got to have faith. You would think that would be enough. No, because faith will get you right through to the throne of God immediately. But it's perseverance, okay, that will stay engaged in faith, enabling God to break through as he does here, the supernatural. Now, go on to 13 and 14 with me, well-known verses. He says, "The prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 21 days. Astonishing. You know, there are levels of supernatural principalities and powers that have great authority. He withstood me 21 days. But Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me. So I left him there with the prince of the kingdom of Persia and came to make you understand what is to befall your people in the latter days." And folks, when we pray, there's a lot more going on than we understand. A lot more going on than we understand. We're much too simplistic about the spiritual realm, you know. There were two men sitting on a bench, and one said to the other, "When you get into the presence of God, you know, what will you ask him, you know?" And one said, "Oh, you know, I'll ask him, you know, about, you know, the creation and, you know, the days, the 7 days and whatever." And he said, "What would you ask him?" And he said, "Well," he said, "I would like to ask him why there was a Kosovo and why there was a Holocaust and why there was a Sudan and why there were 100 and I would like to ask God why don't you do something about it? But he said, I won't. And he said, why won't you ask him that? So I won't ask him because he might ask me the same question. Okay? He might ask me the same question. And so what's happening here, you see, is don't moan at heaven. Get angry at the devil. We're supposed to use anger, but we misinterpret. This is laid into the Old Testament. In fact, Israel's first battle, okay, when Israel first goes into battle, Moses leaves the battlefield, goes up the hill, because he knows the real battle is going to happen on another level. This is the first time the people of God ever go into battle, Exodus 17. Okay, the Red Sea wasn't a battle, they didn't fight. This is the Amalekites, first time. Hey, aren't we supposed to learn something? How do we fight? How do we get through? And this is the book of Daniel again. Then a couple of other things, just finishing here. You'll notice that the message to Daniel is mediated by an angel. Okay, this is very typical of apocalyptic. Same happens in Revelation. You remember, in fact, John wants to bow down and worship. And he says, hey, don't do that. I'm just like you. Worship God. And so and why it happens is because this stuff, apocalyptic, is largely taking place in heaven. And we don't know our way round in heaven. So we need an angel to give us a tour and to interpret these mystical symbols. Whereas Isaiah doesn't get an angel because he's not apocalyptic. He's describing things on the earth which he can understand. But Daniel needs one, and so does Zechariah, and so does John in the book of Revelation. Now, verse 20, if you turn there, is very interesting, very significant. Verse 20, then he said, do you know why I have come to you? And we're going to find out in chapter 11 in a minute. But now I will return, notice this, to fight against the prince of Persia, and when I'm through with him, lo, the prince of Greece will come, and he'll fight with him. The prince of Greece will come 214 years later. Now this is astonishing. You see, it's almost like, you know, we think, well, you know, he's going to fight with the prince of Persia today, and, you know, he's going to win that one, and next week he's going to fight with the prince of... I'm going to fight with the prince of Persia, I'm going to deal with him, and then the prince of Greece, which is 214 years later. I mean, that's a long time, you see, and it's almost as if we're given a little window here into understanding that God is engaged. Whether it's Michael or Gabriel or us in the heavenlies, hey, we are battling to see his kingdom come and his will be done and everlasting righteousness really, really being brought in. That's an astonishing verse, 214 years away, yet he's anticipating that conflict even now. One thing before we get into chapter 11, chapter 11, we begin to see the huge impacts that this period of time, you remember, was Babylon, it was Media, it was Persia, and it was Greece, about 586 through to 165. This had a huge impact on Israel, and we're going to get the storyline again in chapter 11. Going to go through the same story again. But just again to go back to the historical bookends here of Daniel, okay, beginning in 586, finishing with Hanukkah in 165, working our way through Babylon, Media, Persia, and Greece. This had a huge impact. Okay, so let me give you one or two examples. When Jesus is born, okay, and a star appears, who are the people that notice it? People from where? Okay, from Babylon, that's right. Because you remember, Daniel is interacting, Daniel has to interact with all the astrologers of the day. You remember that? He has to do that, probably doesn't want to. And they spent as much time looking at the sky as we spend looking at TV. It was their kind of, you know, sky watching was the big thing. And so, hey, don't you think when they were doing that, that Daniel might have referred to the prophecy in Numbers that speaks of this great star that is going to come, this messianic sign. Mm-hmm. Of course he talked to them. How did they know this? Through the book of Daniel, and that's why they come in Matthew. Number two, they're going to learn now in this period Aramaic and Greek, which Aramaic is the language of the East, and Greek is the language of the West. So when the gospel comes, they're going to be fluent in Hebrew, they're going to be fluent in Aramaic, and they're going to be fluent. Our New Testament is going to be written in what? Greek. And when they put the sign over the cross, they had to add one other language as well, which is Latin. And so already, you see, God is preparing now. There's the diaspora, his people being scattered, and he's preparing them out of the little, you know, the little Hebrew kind of ghetto. Now they're becoming multi-ethnic, perhaps more accurately, multi-kind of linguistic, ready for the gospel to come. And then Greece, which we'll see now in chapter 11, really coming on stage, is going to have a huge impact. Even after their defeats under the Maccabees, Greek culture will continue. And so you'll get in the Gospels that Jesus visits the Decapolis. Do you remember that? He goes through the Decapolis preaching and casting out demons. Decapolis, Deca, 10, Polis, city. Okay, the 10 cities, which were in the general region, a little bit kind of east of Galilee. There were 10 Greek cities. And I've showed you before that 5 miles from Nazareth, where Jesus grew up, 5 miles from Nazareth, so he must have often, you know, I would imagine with his friends, you know, walked over there. There was this great city of Sepphoris, this Greek city, of course, Jews lived there as well, but and here's a typical Greek amphitheater holding 4,000 people 4 or 5 miles from Nazareth. This is the impact, okay, this is the impact on this period of time, okay. Okay, Greece has now ended, Rome is rising, but still there's a tremendous legacy, both negatively and positively, deposited among God's people. Daniel chapter 11. I'm not going to read it. It's a very long chapter, and it's a historical chapter taking us through the same period once again. And so verses 1 to 4 will be Xerxes, who is a Persian ruler, attacking Greece. And so verses 1 to 4, we're going to see the end of Persia and the beginning of Greece under Alexander. 5 to 20, this is all on your sheet, we're going to see the battles between the Ptolemies in Egypt and the Seleucids in Syria, Babylon. 5 through 20. The battles of the north and the south. And I'll say more about that in a minute. 21, okay, we get to this Seleucid ruler, Antiochus the IV, renamed himself Antiochus the Divine, Antiochus Epiphanes, okay, who brings in this 7-year persecution, verses 21 to 39. And verses 40 to 45 are probably also about Antiochus, although there's some complexities there which I explain on your handout. So let's just look at one or two of them. Grab your sheets, and I'm going to begin with, now let's read a bit first, chapter 11 and verse 2. He's had this vision of the angel coming to give him now insight again into this historical period that we've worked our way through several times, but now we're going through again. And now I will show you the truth. Behold, 3 more kings shall arise in Persia. Daniel now is living in the reign of the Persian Empire. And a 4th shall be far richer than all of them. And when he has become strong through his riches, he shall stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. This was Xerxes. Verse 3. Then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will, Alexander. And when he has arisen, his kingdom shall be broken and divided towards the 4 winds of heaven, broken into 4 parts. but not to his posterity, because he did not have children. The Persians, led by Xerxes I, invaded Greece in 480 and were defeated. Verse 3 then describes the rise of Alexander in 336. He established the largest empire the world had ever known to this point, from Greece right the way through to India. And he died as a young man. How old was Alexander? 30? In his early 30s. 33. He dies saying there are no more worlds to be conquered. Verse 4, this is where it becomes important, describes, you remember, his empire is broken into four parts. And it's broken into four parts. We've gone through this before, but you need to see it again. This is where it gets important. Okay, one part are called the Ptolemies, down here in the south area of Egypt. The other part, the Seleucids, are up here in Syria, Babylon. There are two other segments to the empire, but they weren't as powerful. Now what happens in chapter 11 is you get this period of history described, okay, where the Ptolemies are trying to extend their power, and the Seleucids are trying to extend their power. Okay, the south and the north engage in battle, and of course often they're in the territory of Israel fighting for oversight of Israel. And so verses 5 to 20, this conflict between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids, that was the breakup of Alexander's empire. Okay, verse 5 to 20, this is paragraph number 1, 2, 3, 4, describe this conflict, okay, eventually arriving, okay, at the Seleucid emperor Antiochus IV, verse 21. And you'll find we're suddenly on very familiar territory once again. Okay, in his place, that's in the place of the previous ruler, who was Seleucus IV, Antiochus IV arises, who renames himself Epiphanes. In his place shall arise a contemptible person to whom royal majesty has not been given. He usurped the throne. He shall come in without warning and obtain the kingdom by flattery. Armies shall be utterly swept away before him and broken, and also the prince of the covenant, which would be the high priest. And he ended the 800-year the dynasty of Zadok. Zadok was initiated by David and Solomon. He ends that dynasty. He kills Onias, high priest, prince of the covenant also. And from that time, and from the time that an alliance is made with him, originally he poses as a friend. He shall act deceitfully, and he shall become strong with a small people, or a small group within Israel. These kind of reformist Jews who are really apostates. Then we move on to the description now, verses 21 to 39, the description of this 7-year period under Antiochus. And again, come with me down to verse 31. It gets very familiar. We've read this before. Forces from him shall appear and profane the temple and fortress, and they will take away the burnt offering, and they shall set up the abomination that makes desolate. And he shall seduce with flattery those who violate the covenants, the apostate Jews. But the people who know their God shall stand firm and take action, which was the Maccabees. And then finally, we get to the end here, verse 40 to 45, which I've described this on your sheet, so I won't go into it in detail. But it's interesting because we can clearly track verses 1 to 39 through history without any difficulty at all. It's more difficult, these last six verses are more difficult to read the history books and to read this. Is probably still Antiochus, but what is done by Daniel is he starts pulling in material from Isaiah, material from Ezekiel, Okay? And then even, you'll notice he comes to an end, verse 45, and he shall pitch his palatial tents between the sea and the glorious holy mountain, which probably is the region of Armageddon. Yet he shall come to his end with none to help him. So whether this is, some people think this might be these last verses, the rise of the Romans. It's probably, I think, Antiochus, but it's slightly more metaphorical because Daniel wants to end the historical section by saying, by indicating, yes, it is, but it's fulfilled, but not quite, because this is window number two, pointing to window number three, pointing to window, okay, number four up here in the book of Revelation. Are you with me? Slightly kind of complex, but I want to finish by reading the first paragraph, because this is what, we don't really need to study chapter 11. You say, well, why is it all there then? Well, let me explain. Chapter 11 constitutes an exposition of secular history. Remember, Daniel is giving us a theology of international affairs. If you want to understand international affairs, you go to Daniel. It gives history more space than in any other chapter of the book, but it renders it essentially meaningless. Meaning belongs to the end, but not to the process. Events in chapter 11 unfold as a pointless sequence of invasions. The north invades the south invades the north, there's an intermarriage, and then it falls apart, etc., etc. Invasions, battles, schemes, frustrations. It's a tale of selfishness, irrationality, and chance. Human beings formulate far-reaching plans, but keep being frustrated by each other. History is going nowhere. God will have to intervene and direct it to the fulfillment of his purposes, which is Daniel chapter 12, which is next week.